All right, welcome back to another episode of The Outlander with me, your host, Mike Maxwell. I'm out here in the Australian wilderness. Well, as you can see behind me, maybe not quite the, maybe not just the wilderness, but it is a beautiful landscape, beautiful, beautiful scene, if I do say so myself. So this is high quality stuff here, guys. You're getting only the best quality here on Hearthfire Radio. So today, I thought we might talk a little bit about the competence crisis and everything that kind of surrounds that. Anything to do with competence. Really what I want to talk about today is how to get good at anything. How to get good at anything. Now that might seem almost like something kind of arrogant to say, you know, that who am I to weigh in on this? I do like to think that I'm pretty good at some things. I've been able to gain competence in certain domains over the course of my life. And there really is only one weird tip involved. And I'm gonna drop that on you guys here in this episode. Really what it is, look, I mean, anything worth knowing has really been known forever. Anything that's worth saying, anything that is worth understanding has been understood by traditional society since the beginning of time. Yes, I mean, you know, there are things that we can learn about whatever, with science, physics, those domains of knowledge increase and are cumulative over time. But the real sort of bare bones and meat and potatoes of what makes, you know, what makes a good life, what is it that will allow you to flourish, is it's not a mystery. It's been known forever. And there's an old fable, everybody knows it, is absolutely proverbial, called The Tortoise and the Hare. And in this fable is really the key to being able to do and learn and accomplish anything in life. Anything that your baseline genetic, you know, natural ability will allow you to achieve can be achieved with the heuristic in that particular fable. But I kind of want to go off in a different direction a little bit. We'll sort of get to it in a roundabout way. I don't know if anybody who's watching has ever watched the movies Friday the 13th, the Friday the 13th series. I certainly haven't watched it in a long time. It's been a dog's age since I watched those movies. And I bet if I watched them now, they're so old, I bet if I watched them now, they wouldn't even really be scary. They'd probably be more funny than they would be scary. But there is something in them that is kind of scary. And that is the character Jason Voorhees, the villain, the guy with the hockey mask and the machete and everything. Jason Voorhees, what makes him terrifying, what makes him scary in that movie, is that he will never, ever, ever stop coming after you. There are many scenes in the movie where you have a kid at camp, or like, you know, this teenage girl or something like that, he's hunting her down, and he's just, I mean, she's running away like as fast as she can. She's scrambling over like trees and rocks and like through the forest and trying to get away, and he's just walking. He's just walking and walking and walking. And it seems ridiculous. Like, what kind of a chase is that? But like, the actual effect, the effect of it is pretty terrifying, because, you know, you can see her. It's like, yeah, I don't know if you guys have ever seen what it looks like when a bear hunts a deer, or like a caribou in Alaska or something like that. There was a video I watched of a bear hunting a deer, and it was the most terrifying thing I'd ever seen. Not because it was gory, you couldn't really see anything that happened after the bear got the deer, it was so far away, but the massive wide expanse of the Alaskan wilderness, it was just this huge, the landscape was so immense, and you could see the deer and the bear are probably like a mile apart. They're like ridiculously far apart when the chase begins, and the deer starts like trotting away, and the bear starts just sort of like lumbering slowly toward the deer. And the video is like 5 or 6, 7 minutes long. It's very long. And as you can see over the course of the video, the chase gets more and more frantic. The deer starts getting more and more spooked as the bear closes in very slowly. It's the bear's never like sprinting. The bear's just, it's just sort of taking his time, you know what I mean? And eventually the deer comes along to like a body of water that the bear kind of gets it between, you know, between a body of water and himself. And the deer jumps into the water. And at that point, it's like, it just can't do anything. It's like, just, it's so bogged down, and the bear eventually catches it up and gets it. But it's, what's terrifying is you can see the slow process of the bear just closing in and closing in and closing in on his prey until eventually he gets him. He gets it. And it's the same thing when you watch the Friday the 13th movies. If you watch those movies, what makes them scary, they're not that scary anymore, but the scary element in it is that Jason Voorhees is just like calmly and persistently closing in on his prey as the prey begins by being spooked and terrified and like making some headway of like getting away from him, but gets tired and eventually, like, you know, the panic turns into an exhaustion, and then the exhaustion turns into a despair, and eventually he gets his prey. And that's what makes it scary. That's what makes those movies scary. Now there's another movie that has, or movie series actually, that has a similar effect. And it's a much more serious movie, and a much more acclaimed movie, shall we say. And that is the Dawn of the Dead. Dawn of the Dead series. I've only actually seen the first one, the original one from the 70s. And I didn't like it when I watched it. Then when I rewatched it, I sort of understood what was going on more, and I understood what makes it so terrifying. And for anybody who's not familiar, again, I haven't seen it in forever, so it's, you know, I probably won't be able to summarize it that in a detailed way. But what happens in the movie is that there's a zombie plague or some sort of an outbreak, and all of humanity is, you know, there's some sort of virus or something like that that turns all of humanity into zombies. And there is a small, there's a little contingent of people. There's a small group of people who are holding off and trying to outlast this plague, this menace, this apocalyptic event. And they eventually sort of hole up in a mall. Which is a great place. It's like the perfect place that you would want to be if in a scenario like that. It, you know, it's kind of fortified. You know, you can lock the doors. There's lots of places to hide. There's like grocery stores with food and stuff. Like, you could last for weeks and weeks and weeks. There's toilets and things. You know, like, this is probably the best case scenario. This is the best place that you could be in a situation like that, where you've got an army of hostile non-humans essentially after you. But what makes Dawn of the Dead so terrifying? What gives the movie the actual effect that it has is the feeling of a grinding inevitability that they will not make it out. That no matter how long they're there, no matter how clever they are, no matter how they sort of marshal their resources and conserve food and everything, eventually the zombies will get in, they will break the doors, they will break something down, they'll get in through the roof, they'll get in through the doors, they'll get in through something, And it doesn't matter how you run or where you hide, you will eventually be gotten. You will eventually be their quarry, and they will get you. That's what I didn't like about this movie. I felt like I was watching it, and it felt like it took hours. Well, I mean, it does, but it felt like it took 5 or 6 hours to watch the movie, because it's just, you feel it. You feel this sort of grinding fatalism, this sort of like destiny inexorably moving towards its fated end. And that's actually, it's kind of hard to watch. And I think that's part of why the movie had the effect that it did, and why it was so famous. So you get these things in these horror movies. You get the feeling that no matter what, you know, as long as there is a slow, iterative, bit-by-bit process, as long as that continues on for long enough, eventually the goal will be achieved. And I think you guys can kind of see where I'm going with this, as far as learning to do something, getting good at anything, and gaining competence. Really what you need to do, the only thing that you need to do, ultimately, in the broadest sense, is not to give up, to be persistent, to keep going. And that is how you get good at anything. Examples here of things in my life where this has worked for me. Number one that comes to mind is playing guitar. Now, my parents were really cool, and they turned me on to music very early. My dad was a musician. My mom would like sing to me and everything. So music kind of runs in my family. And I basically had a guitar thrust into my hand very early. I was quite lucky. My dad set me up with guitar lessons at the age of 8. I mean, I wanted to do it. He had played all kinds of music for me. My favorite album in the world is Christopher Parkening's Parkening Plays Bach. Totally, it just moved me in such a way that was unbelievable when I was very young. And I decided that I wanted to be a classical guitarist. Now, I mean, that's a pretty tall order. Anybody who wants to be a classical anything, classical pianist, classical violinist, cellist, whatever it is, a classical operatic trained singer, you know, these things are very hard. it's a big mountain to climb. So I started out pretty ambitious, wanting to do that. And of course, started out at, you know, ground zero, at the zero mark, with absolutely no skills at all, no ability to play the guitar. And my dad set me up with guitar lessons when I was about 8 years old. And I loved it so much. Just the sheer love of guitar, the sheer love of music propelled me to do pretty well at it at first. I did very well. I performed in a number of like provincial competitions. I won one of them. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And that's what made me so good at guitar at that early age. But the fact is that you can only be so good at something as your natural talent and ability will allow you to be. And, you know, I mean, just my hands are not like huge compared to some people have these like spindly fingers. Like, if you've ever seen Les Claypool play bass, he's got these like gigantic sort of Martian hands or whatever that are just like perfectly suited towards playing the bass. That's not me. You know, I kind of have these like these very thick like man hands that are just like not that dexterous. So that was kind of a not a mark in my favor as a guitar player. And as I got a little bit older, and other friends of mine, in high school especially, who I met up with, had been kind of on a similar path to me. Maybe they have a little bit more natural ability. I would meet up with them and just be absolutely blown away by how good they are. Very humbled. It's a very humbling thing when you come across someone that is a natural talent or a genius at something. It's very humbling. And I remember I had a friend in high school who we were both into classical guitar. We were both into, like, you know, a lot of what was going on at the time, which was sort of the tail end of grunge rock and going into sort of like, you know, prog rock, Radiohead kind of thing. That's what's going on for me in high school. We love the same music, and we especially love Bach, both of us. So we learned a few duets on classical guitar, and it was always like, you know, I was like the stupid kid that would just not be able to do it. You know what I mean? Not that I couldn't do it. I could do it. It just took me five times as much effort and practice to be able to play these duets as it would for him. I mean, he could almost sight read it basically because he was so good. And it's a very humbling experience. Very humbling experience. But of course, high school is not the end of life. That's not the end. You go on to do many more things in life. And fast forward some 25 or so years, and I don't live in Canada anymore. I don't live in my hometown. I moved far, far away. And when I go back, I very often see people that I haven't seen for a very long time. And going back and seeing him the last time, he wasn't a guitar player anymore. He had given it up at some point. I mean, he could still play. It's the kind of thing where you can always it's like riding a bike. You can always kind of do something, but, you know, over time you get very rusty, very, very rusty if you don't practice, especially classical guitar. And so all of my worry about him sort of overtaking me and being so much better of a guitar player than I was really all for naught, because I still play guitar. I had continued to play guitar up until that point in my life. And I was able to hand him the recording of my latest album at the time. And he, you know, and no shade against him or anything, but he didn't have anything. He didn't have anything to show for it. He had become a dad, which is great. That's awesome. It's so much more important than being a guitarist. He had basically given it up and gone in a completely other direction in life. So, yeah, if you slow and steady wins the race, that is the sort of root lesson behind all of this stuff, you know. And there are a number of other things in life I can point to that where this has been the case, where this has been my rule of thumb or my approach or my heuristic, and it's absolutely worked for me in ways that go beyond natural talent and natural ability. One, for example, would be diet and exercise. So, I was always pretty athletic in high school, and, you know, played hockey, played soccer, played football. You know, I was always playing sports up until I was about 16 or 17 years old, and then I started smoking cigarettes, and that was basically the end of that. That was the end of my sports career, such as it was. But I was always in pretty good shape in high school. And then the sort of tack that my life took, the direction that I went in, was basically to become a musician in my 20s and on much too late into my 30s, to be honest. I decided that I was going to be a musician. And as a musician, I really had absolutely no need for physical activity. I had no interest in it. I even stopped reading for a long time. I was just doing music and that's it. Thankfully, I didn't pick up any real drug habits or anything, but it wasn't great. It wasn't great for my physical well-being. It wasn't great for my physique. And certainly, in the later stages of being a musician, when I kind of realized it was not going to happen for me and I decided that I would become a studio engineer instead, working in a studio is not a great job for physical fitness. You're working very weird hours. Very often you're working a ton of hours. Like, you know, you might work 100 hours in a week and then 0 hours the next week or something like that. You're going to be working a lot of overnights unless you are a very in-demand producer. You got to work overnights because a lot of musicians, you know, they're working too. They have jobs. They can only afford to really do it overnight. That's when studio time is cheap. So yeah, you're going to be working some strange hours, and working these strange hours was not at all conducive to my health, to my physical fitness. And over time, I became quite obese, I guess. Not that obese, but like verging into the obese category. I was definitely overweight, and it did not look very good at that stage. And this went on for quite a long time until I moved from Canada. And once I'd moved, you know, coming to Australia, basically tried to sort of restart the audio engineering, career. But, you know, that's a career that you kind of, I mean, I'd spent 10 years building up a name for myself as a musician and as a studio engineer, in the city that I was in. I came to Australia and I had to start from zero. So that was kind of, it took a little while, but I eventually realized that that career wasn't for me either. So I got out of the studio engineer, the music business basically. And at that point I was not in good shape, not at all in good shape. And I was verging on my 40s. And in fact, it wasn't really until I was over 40 that I decided to get in shape and to get jacked if I could. Now, this is a very late start, getting into shape and having a good physique, starting at 40. So I had all the natural disadvantages in the world, but I had one advantage. And this advantage has been with me all my life. And that advantage is that I am persistent and I don't give up. I will never give up. So this is why, you know, it's not a good idea to become the enemy of Mike from Imperium Press, because he holds a grudge and he doesn't give up. So anyway, that all aside, I started educating myself. I started learning what I need to know to get in shape. Because you can't just start doing push-ups. I mean, you can start doing that, but your gains are gonna atrophy over time. You're not gonna be able to maintain the level of progress by doing it and having no idea what the hell you're doing. So I started learning and learning and learning and binging fitness videos, muscle gain, and that kind of stuff. I could name any number of names, there's so many of them. I started learning all that I could, and it was really a mindset thing. This is something that Marcus has talked about in the first video for his Physique Manufactorum series. It's really all about mindset. And I had the mindset that I'd better get this under control, because this is really kind of the last chance, you know, starting to get in shape in middle age. That's no joke. So I had the mindset. My mindset was, you just keep going and you just keep going and you keep learning and you keep doing the exercise, and all, you sprained a muscle or you did whatever, so you take a deload, you take some time off, and then you get back at it. Do not let that fall off the bandwagon. So, you know, and over time, it's been years now. It's been about 4 years since that started. And now I'm in pretty damn good shape. I'm in much better shape. I'm in better shape than I was in high school. Still have a couple pounds to lose, but you know, the fact is I've never been as strong as I am now. Not even when I had everything going for me. When I was 17 years old. Not even when I was a jock, basically. So it's persistence really is the key at getting good at anything. Another example I could give of this, which is very similar in many ways, is learning Latin, of all things. You could think getting jacked and learning a dead language, those sound worlds apart, but certainly in terms of my personal situation, it was basically the same thing, and it was basically the same time. For whatever reason, I just decided when I was in my late 30s to go on a personal improvement kick, and learning Latin was one thing that I wanted to do. And you know, it's very similar, actually, getting jacked and learning a language, in that those are things that is really a young man's game. That's something you should be doing when you were young. It's certainly much easier when you're young. I mean, if you haven't started by the time you're 40 or whatever it is, I mean, you can still do it. It just takes so much more effort. And so what I would do, I got myself all the materials that I wanted. I did the research. I got Wheelox Latin, which is the premier Latin course, the best one, I would say, apart from the one that we are working on. There's another good one called Lingua Latina. But I did Wheelox, because Wheelox is a much more classical approach to learning Latin. It is the grammar translation method rather than the natural method. The natural method is how people learn when they're children. They're thrown into it. You just speak the language. There's no textbook. There's no nothing. There's no grammar lessons. It's like immersion. In Canada, we have something called French immersion school, where if you want your child to learn French, you just put them into a school where they speak French. And, you know, very quickly, they learn to speak French. That's the natural method. But I did it the other way. I did it the classical Victorian way, grammar translation method, with drills and exercises and some reading, of course, But it was a much more brute force method. And I chose that one because I figured that those people were a pretty impressive lot, the Victorians, and that I wanted to learn the way they learned. So I did that. I got the Wheelox textbook. I got all the supplementary textbooks, all the exercise books, all the reading books, all the everything. And I just sat down, and rather than getting real juiced up about it and getting a big head of steam, making a lot of progress and then forgetting about it, I decided to go a little bit every day, half an hour a day. I would set aside at work, you know, rather than eating lunch or while I'm eating lunch. I would sit there for half an hour and I would do Latin exercises. And people would come into my office and say, and they would laugh. They would just be like, what are you doing? What are you doing here? What are you working on? Are you like getting an accountant's degree or something? They see me with the textbook open and everything. They'd be like, are you getting an accountant's degree? And I'm like, no, I'm learning Latin. And they would just laugh, you know, which is kind of silly. I mean, for most people, it's kind of silly. But, you know, again, flash forward 3 or 4 years, and I'm reading unadapted Latin. I'm reading Caesar's commentaries, which is something quite amazing. I haven't really talked about this much in the last few years, Latin. I used to talk about it a lot more when Imperium had just started, because it was kind of, you know, I was still actually doing the exercises at that stage. But learning a language like that, especially a dead language, something like Old English or Latin or Greek, is like getting a mind meld, like a connection with a completely alien culture. Even if it is our culture, like Old English, it's still very different. And it's a hell of a thing. It's a hell of a thing to be able to do that. And it's an accomplishment. You know, I I would never really sort of like wave it around like a flag or whatever to make myself look cool. But, you know, back when I did talk about Latin a lot more and everything, people were very, it was very impressive. People would be like, wow, I can't believe that you've like learned to do that. It's like an amazing thing to know how to do. Yeah, it's kind of useless, but it's like still, it takes a lot. It takes a lot of skill and perseverance and energy to do that. So it was something that I was very proud of. I'm still proud of. But I don't really think about it much anymore. I more just use it. I just use it as a thing. You know, I translate Latin texts when I need to, which has come in very handy for Imperium. That was not something that I'd planned, but it did come in handy. And it's something that I learned how to do. And I learned how to do it because the way that you get good at anything, or the way that a bear catches a caribou, or the way that Jason Voorhees catches his prey, is slow and steady wins the race. Makes me think of a thing that happened quite a long time ago now when I was a kid. It's funny how guys are, the way that men interact with each other, and the way that men, you know, the way that our sociality works, the way that our groups work, you know, groups of men. It's very different than the way it works with women. With guys, there's a pecking order, and it has to be set. The pecking order has to be in place, and if it's not, it's just the group will. You will never be friends. You will never be a team. You will never work together until everybody has his place in the hierarchy. So very often, what will happen with guys, and women do not understand this. Very often, what will happen with men is that it actually requires that we get in a fight with each other before we can be friends. I think a lot of guys will hear that and be like, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. Any of the ladies who are listening will just be like, what the hell are you, like, what is that even? That makes no sense. But it's the way it is. It's the way it is with men. We have to establish the pecking order or we're not happy and we hate each other. And that's how it happened with me and my friends back in the day. I had a friend, you know, I moved to a street, my family moved around a fair bit in my hometown. Moved to this one street. It was the first place that I had lived where there was a lot of kids there my age. It was awesome. It was like the best time of my life. And I'm great friends with those guys now, still to this day. But at first we weren't all friends. In fact, I made friends with the guy across the street. And he was friends with the kid up the road, but I wasn't friends with the kid up the road. So we kind of had this, like, you know, there was a mutually antagonistic relationship. We were both like, me and this other guy were like both friends with this third person. But we weren't friends with each other or whatever. Well, we kind of were. Well, nowadays they would call it frenemies, I suppose. That's what we were. And I still remember the time when we did become friends. It was actually a very Canadian situation where we were tobogganing. There was a golf course that was close by, lived close to a golf course, and in the winter the golf course closes and they were cool about it. They don't do this anymore because, you know, we live in a low trust society now, but back then we lived in a much higher trust society, so they would just let kids go onto the golf course and go tobogganing, and it was wonderful. It was so much fun. And I remember one time, me and this guy, my frenemy, we were tobogganing. Something happened. I don't know what it was. There was some sort of a altercation, and we got into a fight. And we both beat the tar out of each other. But the way that it went down was kind of interesting, and I think worth noting. where him and I squared up, and I don't know why, but my strategy for this fight was basically to let him beat the crap out of me until he was tired. So that's what I did. I just stood there and he kept punching and I kept taking punches left and right and center. And I kept getting punched and punched and punched. And eventually he ran out of steam. Eventually he started like throwing haymakers and he was just like clearly sort of, you know, I don't know if you guys can see that. Got the Air Force out here. Anyway, eventually he got tired. And then all I did was I just walked up to him and I pushed him over a ledge into a deep ravine. Thankfully, he didn't break his leg or anything like that, but I won the fight because I didn't give up, right? It's the same thing. I don't need to keep belaboring the same point. It's the same idea, right? If you are resilient, if you can take a punch, if you can fail over and over and over and over and over again until you succeed, whereas the other guy fails and fails and fails and gives up, if that's you, you will always, always be a winner in life. And this is the lesson. This is the lesson of the tortoise and the hare, Aesop's fable, right? Really, if you can internalize the lessons in traditional fables, folklore, and mythology, that is all you need in life. There's no, you know, it's especially a thing on the left, but even on the right, guys really get tired of just hearing the basics over and over and over again. You know, don't give up. You know, build yourself up into something good. Go armed. You know, worship your ancestors. The basics, the absolute basics. Guys get tired of that. We love novelty. Much to our detriment. We love novelty. We want to hear hot takes. I don't like hot takes. I think hot takes suck. I like cold takes. I like takes that are like glacially iced over Antarctic takes. Those are the takes I like. Because you know what? Those are the things that are actually true. Those are the things that really, really track reality. And one of those things you can see in The Tortoise and the Hare, where the one with all the natural advantages in the world loses out to the one who's resilient and persistent. So I think that's a lesson worth pondering. Thanks for listening, guys. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.